Ranger George Russell, who we'll be meeting in a moment. Before we meet him, let's listen to a selection from one of his recent albums. This is him leading his big band. We're going to hear Living Time, composed and arranged by George Russell.
Thank you.
composed in 1972, that was Living Time. Recorded in 1978, it was written and arranged by George Russell, who conducted his big band. And with me now is jazz composer and arranger George Russell, whose work has been central to the development of modern jazz music and theory. Jazz critic John Zwed has written about him. Russell was the first jazz composer to understand the logic of 20th century musical theory in conjunction with the insights of jazz. Russell came at the same questions that Schoenberg had addressed, with an equally radical sense of relativity, but also with a perspective formed within black aesthetics, and he produced a totally original synthesis. At the New England Conservatory of Music, he teaches a theory of music which has found a way to bring Bach, Schoenberg, and Coltrane into the same conceptual world, something that universities have not dared to try seriously, unquote John Zwed. For about 30 years, Russell has been developing his Lydian chromatic concept, a music theory related to the philosophical and musicological relationship of chords and modes. He published his first book on the subject in 1953 and has been working on a second volume. George Russell began his career as a jazz drummer when he was a teenager. He soon abandoned his career as an instrumentalist in favor of devoting his time to composing and arranging. The first of his compositions featured on record was the 1947 Dizzy Gillespie big band session Cubana B, Cubana Bop, which is generally considered the first big band orchestration to blend jazz and Latin rhythms. In 1953, Russell introduced the then virtually unknown pianist Bill Evans in his Concerto for Billy the Kid. Russell soon after formed his own sextet and orchestra, which featured such musicians as Eric Dolphy, Bill Evans, and Barry Galbraith. Russell played piano on the sextet dates. He moved to Europe for most of the 1960s, and since 1969 has lived in Cambridge and has taught at the New England Conservatory of Music. He hasn't led that many performances in America since he left for Europe, and in the late 70s he reformed his big band, which has recorded twice, but seldom performed outside of Boston, and you'll have an opportunity to hear the band in 2 weeks. That's 2 weeks from tonight, when George Russell will lead his band in concert at the Afro-American Museum as part of the Cool Jazz Festival. He's in Philadelphia today to speak tomorrow at the Philadelphia International Jazz Arts Conference, a two-day symposium of talks and performance workshops sponsored by WRTI Radio, Temple University's student radio station, which specializes in jazz programming. That's at the Tomlinson Theater at 13th and Norris Streets. For information about the symposium, you can call 787-8405. For information about the concert 2 weeks from today featuring the George Russell Big Band, you can call 574-0380. That's 574-0380. George Russell, welcome to Fresh Air. It's really a great pleasure to meet you.
Thank you.
I'm kind of surprised that you started as a drummer, since your ultimate interest seems to lay in such things as harmonics and chords, which is something that a drummer doesn't involve themselves with in the same way that, say, a pianist or a guitarist does.
Well, my first impulse in this music, and I think many of jazz's great musicians were first attracted to the music by the inherent energy of the music. And the energy of the music is centered inherently around the drums, you know, because we're talking about Afro-American music, and I would assume that maybe the drums were the first musical instrument that probably the species developed. You know, and it's this energy that is radiated by the percussion. This is what lies at the root of the energy in jazz. So whether we have other inclinations, tonal inclinations, whether to be melodious, or whether it goes in that direction, or harmonious, or polyphonic, or contrapuntal, whatever, it's rhythm that is at the source of this unique indigenous American music.
What made you realize, though, that what you really wanted to devote your life to was composing and arranging and not being an instrumentalist?
Well, I was always in a rather precarious state of health, and I got damn tired of carrying the drums around, you know, for one thing. At the very root of it is the fact that I heard, while I was playing drums in New York with Benny Carter, I had, in 1944, we were at Low East State on Broadway, and so I heard about the new music that was going on, and I walked between shows over to 52nd Street and heard Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, and maybe it was Bud or Al Haig on piano, and Max Roach on drums. And when I heard Max play, I made a then and there decision that drums wasn't for me. And sure enough, 2 weeks later, he took my place with Benny Carter.
When you heard Parker and the others who you mentioned play, did that start to change your view of chords and harmonies?
Well, of course, it was a shock, you know. But my inclinations were harmonic at the time, and it didn't register right away, you know. Although there were certainly very different harmonic implications in the music that they played. I got it from Monk. I was more, and it took a little while to sink in. With me, things register a bit slowly. But what was extremely obvious to me at almost the very first moment of hearing Max play is, number one, he didn't expend any energy, hardly, and that what came out was fantastic energy that was far beyond me to ever reproduce on drums. And Max and I are very good friends as of this day, this moment, you know. But I owe Max a vote of thanks for that. And the world owes him a vote of thanks for not having another mediocre drummer around.
In 1947, the first recording was made of one of your pieces, Cubana Be Cubana Bop.
It's a piece co-written with Gillespie.
You arranged it?
No, I composed parts of it, you know.
Well, we're going to hear Cubana Be Cubana Bop. Can you talk a little bit about the kinds of musical thoughts that you were implementing in
sure.
your role in that piece?
Well, after deciding to give up drums, I returned to my hometown, Cincinnati, and began to really work hard at the piano, you know, with chords. And by that time, I had learned a little bit about just the very basic rudiments of Western theory, enough to be able to begin to write, you know. I didn't know much more than how to spell the various chords. I mean, in other words, the tones that were in certain chords, I knew that. And I knew a little bit about how to, the difference between a half note and a whole note and an eighth note, and not too much more than that. And I began to just write for the local bands, you know. And it wasn't long after that I left for Chicago, and I guess this was only about 5 months after leaving Carter. I went to Chicago to live and met the band at the Downtown Theater and rehearsed them in my first successful big band arrangement. And Benny liked it, and he bought the arrangement, you know. So that, after a year in Chicago and doing music for the show at the El Grotto for Earl Hines Band, and spending a year playing drums with the Eugene Wright's group called the Dukes of Swing, Gene Wright, the bass player with Brubeck, I came on to New York with two young fellas that insisted that I listen to bebop very carefully, and it was their names were Robert Gay, called Little Diz, and Henry Pryor, called Little Bird. And with them, we got on a bus and we went to New York with $25 between the three of us, got a room at the Hotel Braddock on 126th Street and I guess Lenox Avenue, and lived in that for a while and finally couldn't make it anymore, so I had to just spend nights. It was nice, though, in the summer in Gracie Park until I finally remembered that I had put up the Ellington Band in Cincinnati when they didn't have a place to stay. Part of the Ellington Band, Al Hibbler and Skippy Williams, Ray Nance. And so they had all said, if you ever come to New York and you need a place to stay, you know, give us a call. So I gave Skippy a call. He said, sure, come on over. So I went over and stayed with Skippy until I was able to meet Dizzy and through Max, and sold an arrangement to Diz. And with that money, I got an apartment on 48th Street. And then the band used to come to my place during breaks, Dizzy and Bird. And Dizzy one day said, you know, I have a piece, and I'd like for you to maybe you could do something with it, you know. And he played this AABA form, seven bars a piece, and there was a middle section, a C section, very beautiful, 16 bars. And then I made a suite out of it. I added the first movement to it and the last movement. But by that time, I had become very friendly with a trumpet player who was trying to make his way then. And he said, you know, George, I'd like to really learn all the chords. And it was that remark that made me wonder how he'd go about learning the chords. And then I reasoned that for every chord, there must be a scale that sounds closer to that chord than any other scale. In other words, it's scale of unity. So for the first movement of Cubana B, Cubana Bop, I chose a C7th with a, I have to get into slightly technical terms, of flat ninth, augmented ninth, and a flat five. And I knew by that time that the scale of unity was the B-flat, a scale I call the B-flat auxiliary diminished scale. Whole step, half step, whole step, half step, whole step, half step. And I based the first movement not on the chord, but I realized that you could sound, you, without the chord being present, you could convey the genre, the harmony of the chord with its mode of absolute unity. So I'd use the mode contrapuntally to convey the sound of this one chord, and that was my first modal composition.
Did you lecture to the Gillespie band about the theory behind it, or did you just give them the score?
I didn't lecture to them about the theory behind it, because this was intuitive knowledge. I mean, it was intuitive, so it wasn't at a degree in me of depth, the knowledge, so that I could cohesively convey it to someone. But I knew that it was there, you know.
Okay, well, why don't we hear Cubana B, Cubana Bop, George Russell, Dizzy Gillespie collaboration recorded in 1947. Thank you.
Simba, 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 Ubanobi, Ubanoba, 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 Ubanobi.
Cubana B, Cubana Bop, a collaboration between George Russell and Dizzy Gillespie. That was Chano Pozo on drums, and my guest is composer and arranger George Russell, who's in Philadelphia to speak at a conference on jazz being held at the Tomlinson Theater at Temple University. And in 2 weeks, he'll be leading his big band in a concert at the Afro-American Museum. It's 2 weeks from tonight, and that's part of the Cool Jazz Festival. Well, before we talk some more, I just have a bulletin I want to relay to you. Amtrak officials say that a passenger train en route from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C. has derailed in southwest Philadelphia. Four cars are on their sides, and there are reports of approximately 100 minor injuries. No deaths have been reported, but Amtrak officials say they do not know the full extent of injuries, nor exactly how many of the 300 passengers were injured. Amtrak reports service between Wilmington, Delaware, and Philadelphia has been halted because of the derailment. SEPTA is also reporting no service on the Marcus Hook line, where buses will be used instead. Also, SEPTA is reporting no service on the Route 36 trolley. Trains are leaving Philadelphia to northbound points, but not on the usual schedules. Expect delays. And we'll have more updates on that as we get them. Well, with me on Fresh Air is jazz arranger and composer George Russell. And, well, we just heard Cubana B, Cubana Bop, which you recorded, which the Dizzy Gillespie Band recorded. There's already a revolution going on in jazz then, the revolution of, you know, of bop chords and harmonies. But what you were doing was different from that. Did you find that people were resistant to your expansion of the changes that had already begun to happen? And you're also more kind of theoretical approach to music?
Well, all of that is, our concept of theory is somewhat narrow, I must say, a theoretical approaches, and it's connected with a rather academic notion of what knowledge really is, you know? For one thing, the gentleman you quoted in the beginning said that it was my knowledge of 20th century music that I forget the exact quote, but he sort of inferred that I had a huge amount of knowledge of 20th century music. Well, that's absolutely untrue. The Lydian concept, which I evolved, I avoid, evolved as a means intuitively of self-education. As I said, I knew the tones in a few chords, and I did know intervals because modern music education doesn't stress the atom of music. It doesn't place emphasis on it. So I meet college graduates who barely know who graduate in music and have PhDs and don't know intervals, really, you know. But it's a concept of theory that is our concept of theory, which is extremely questionable, you know. And I don't buy it at all that it has to come through an academic institution. I think what we don't understand is that Charlie Parker was a theorist. Everybody who ever broke away from the Johannes Fuchs, and I'm not using four-letter words on your show, it's F-U-X, has been a rebel, you know, with a cause. Ravel he revolted against the rules of the Conservatory of Paris. Debussy, my God, you know. I mean, Stravinsky, you know. They all had their own theorists. Everybody who's ever innovated in music, Bach, they put him in jail for innovating and breaking the laws, you know. Musicians, Charlie Parker is his own theorist. We like to think that all of this music simply came from heart and feeling. Well, of course it did, but it came from an intellect of the heart too, you know, an intuitive intellect that didn't remain intuitive. Coltrane had a chart of the keys on the wall, and Giant Steps is a perfect equilateral triangle.
But it's been very important to you to get the intuitive theory into words. You've written one book on your theory and have another one in the works. Why is it so important to you? You could leave an intuitive thing and just have the music, and musicians could listen to it and try to kind of crack the the code that you've created.
Because I think it might be my most important contribution to it's a debt I owe to the forces that are responsible for my existence, you know. It's my debt to being alive, you know, and because I feel it's an objective concept. By that I mean I don't feel it applies simply to music. I feel it applies, I think there is something there that within music there is an explanation for music from which we can learn how to not only survive this life, but how to transcend, you know?
Can I ask you to give a layman's capsule of the Lydian concept?
Well, as I said, a certain trumpet player in New York said, after I began to know him and go to his house then quite often, said that he wanted to learn all the chords. That was his ambition. And that one statement made me think of, now, how would Miles Davis go about learning all of these chords, you know? And then I figured that for every chord, there must be a scale that was a unity. And my first big shock was to find out that the major scale is not a unity with its tonic major chord, you know? And it's a provable fact, you know? I would have to get into a little something technical to show you, but the fourth degree, the fa, do, re, mi, fa, the fa in the major scale prevents it from being a unity with its chord, like a tonic major chord. So therefore, it relates to C major in a different way. C major, for the C major scale, the C major chord And the tonic tone C is a goal that it's reaching for. It's in a state of resolution to C, but it's not a unity with C, because you can't make a ladder of fifths out of the C major scale, a ladder of intervals of fifths like C, G, D, A, E, B, F sharp is a Lydian scale, not a major scale. The major scale, to get it, you'd have to alter the sixth fifth B to F sharp to B to F. And that keeps the major scale in a state of linear, goal-seeking resolution. It's trying to become a unity with its tonic tone. The Lydian scale, on the other hand, is an absolute unity with its tonic major chord and tonic tone. So then there, it occurred to me that jazz musicians are really scientists. They're physicists. What they've been trying to tell us all these years, Coleman Hawkins, by emphasizing each verticality in each vertical chord in a song, by sensing that there was a certain tones had an affinity with that chord, and his tendency to be vertical was entirely different than Lester Young's tendency to sort of play over the a number of chords and play to the point to which these chords were resolving. So there's the active and passive force in music, the horizontal and the vertical, you know?
Why don't we listen to another one of your pieces and hear an example of what you're describing. We're going to hear Concerto for Billy the Kid, which features Bill Evans. Would you say a little bit about how what you've been talking about applies to what we're about to hear briefly?
Well, that was written in 1956, and by that time I had codified the basic principles of the concept pretty well, and just happened to meet one day a friend of mine, Lucy Reed, a singer from Chicago, was in New York on a hot Sunday and wanted us to, my wife and I, to meet a friend of hers. And we met him, and we all went on a boat ride, and she just mentioned that was a pianist. And I said, fine, why don't you come home and play a little? And this fellow who was very quiet, and I was just sort of being courteous, and he sat down at the piano, and my mouth fell open, you know, and I realized that here was an incredible musician, you know, so I asked him to play on the album.
Okay, well, with Bill Evans at the piano, this is Concerto for Billy the Kid, written and arranged by my guest, George Russell. recorded in 1956 with Bill Evans at the piano. That was Concerto for Billy the Kid, written and arranged by my guest George Russell, who's based in Cambridge, Massachusetts, teaches at the New England Conservatory of Music, and is in Philadelphia to speak tomorrow at a jazz conference at Temple University's Tomlinson Theater. And he'll be leading his big band in a performance 2 weeks from tonight at the Afro-American Museum as part of the Cool Jazz Festival. The time that you started composing and arranging was also the time that there was much more of an emphasis being put on the soloist. Big bands were becoming extinct, I think. Did you ever feel a certain frustration at wanting to use, for instance, a big band at a time when there weren't many of them anymore?
Well, I mean, if being an artist is a frustrating career, actually. You know, I never thought of entering the big band business when it was becoming extinct. You simply accommodate yourself to some other, especially when you're in your formative years, you accommodate yourself to some other means of expression in your particular art form, you know.
So you chose smaller groups?
Smaller groups, yeah.
On some of your dates, like the sextet dates, you're featured at the piano, but you've mostly used other pianists on your work, though you've, since giving up drums, become a pianist yourself. What's your reason for featuring other pianists and not performing yourself?
I'm not a pianist. I play the Lydian concept, that's all, you know. I never played piano in my life until I did my first record date. And then I had to play something, so by that time I knew the concept pretty well, you know, so I could get through on piano, you know. So it was the first Riverside date that I ever played piano on professionally. Otherwise, I just played enough to help me compose and arrange, you know. I don't really consider myself a pianist.
Can you get the ideas that you're hearing in your head into your fingers easily?
Oh, yeah, sure. It becomes an extension of my intuitive system, and intuitively I can do it, yeah.
You spent most of the 1960s in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
What was your reason?
Not most, the latter part, 65, 69.
What was your reason for leaving the States?
I didn't feel a receptivity. I felt a great hostility here at the time to pick a particular way I wanted to develop as a person and as an artist, you know. And I found what I was looking for in Europe.
What was that?
Respect as an artist, which I'd never really had, which translated out to respect as a person, you know, which was never really, as a man, I mean, it wasn't granted here, you know. And in order to make a contribution to the country, I had to leave it, you know.
Were you exposed to different sounds or different music living in a different country?
Well, what I was exposed to here was a great deal of racial hatred, you know, which, as Miles says in a book that I bought recently called Round About Midnight by Eric Nissenson, in which, incidentally, he refers to an evening when I had gotten the Lydian concept together, after I'd gotten it together, and we sat down and I explained it to him. His comment was, if Bird were alive, this would have killed him. And then he went on to record Milestones. So it's an interesting book, but as he said, prejudice really was the fuel that made him need to become a thoroughgoing, innovative, and one of the greatest artists of our time, you know.
Well, you moved back to America, and I think it was 1969.
Right.
Started teaching at the New England Conservatory of Music.
Right.
Did the racial situation change any then?
I was ready for it when I came back because I felt that I mean, it was in 65, it was time to cross the great waters, you know? And in 69, it was time to cross the great waters back and come back because America had seemed that America was in a time when it was done something that it had hardly, to my knowledge, ever done. At least history books in school didn't show me that America had self-examined itself or become introspective, you know? And this was extremely interesting, and it created a very opportune time and energy and environment for the arts, I felt, and a very exciting opportunity to come back and try to contribute something to my homeland, you know, in which I'd never felt at home.
When you feel that kind of racism, does that not only affect the you know, your ability to become known or to play or stuff, but does it affect the way you feel about your own writing? I mean, your ability to actually create when you feel that you're being, you know, that you as an artist face discrimination? Does it make it hard to work
well? You know, as I said to you, what it does is it sets a fire going in you, you know? You know? A fire to become.
You've been now, to my knowledge, composing only when commissioned. There's an old stereotype of the composer who has so much music whizzing around his head all the time that it just has to spill out onto the paper. What do you do with the music that you're hearing when you're not when you're not being commissioned to compose something?
If I get an idea, you know, of that nature, an extremely inspirational idea, which is very rare, then I make sure it gets cataloged, you know? I don't wait on inspiration. My life's work actually is embodied in the Lydian chromatic concept, you know? And it's interesting I believe it's borne fruit in this music since the modal revolution and since even pop music today. I'm listening to Michael Jackson, and one of the tunes on there is all in a Lydian scale. So I want to get something started, I believe, or I don't, whatever the name of it is, you know. So it's not simply that the fact that music is, that it may have had an input into music, but it's what it's trying to say, and I owe it my first allegiance in terms of not writing music unless I'm commissioned. I really believe that composers and artists should be paid, you know? And I don't know where anybody got it, the idea that they should just sit in a garret and create and only come into their own after they can't tolerate being on Earth any longer, you know, and cut their ear off or something, you know. I don't intend to do that.
Right. We're unfortunately running out of time, but you've worked with many different musicians as a band leader. Do you look for a certain sympathetic response in musicians, people who will really understand what it is musically that you're striving for, and who will kind of understand the whole concept of your music, not just what's written on the page. And how do you find the people who you think are going to work for you in a band?
Oh, you mean in terms of musicians?
Yeah, in terms of musicians.
They have to have a certain energy.
Uh-huh.
I don't care what they look like, anything else, but they have to have an energy. They have to have a sense of excitement about what we're doing, you know? And they can't have a thoroughly sterile professional. I can't use that kind of player. I don't care. I mean, who's talking about them, you know? I need fire. As Cocteau said, they asked him, what would you take if you had to live this life over again? He said, I would take the fire. I'll take the fire.
Okay, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us. It's really been interesting to have you here.